The Afterword is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/afterword. That's W-O-R-D.
I'm June Thomas, welcoming you to The Afterword, a Slate podcast in which I talk with the authors of new nonfiction books. My guest today is New York Times reporter Pam Bellock, whose book Island Practice, Cobblestone Rash, Underground Tom, and Other Adventures of a Nantucket Doctor has just been published by Public Affairs. Pam, thanks so much for coming into the Slate studio.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Island Practice is a gripping story about an unusual physician and a very unusual place. Tell us about Dr. Timothy Leprey and Nantucket, where he practices.
Well, Dr. Timothy Leprey is the only surgeon on Nantucket. He's been there for about 30 years. And he's not just a surgeon. It turns out that he has sort of become the go-to guy for almost anything medical and even non-medical on the island. So he's the medical examiner and the football team doctor and the hospital medical director, and he's a tick disease expert, and he'll fix up your animals and be your sort of unofficial and a bit unorthodox psychologist.
Yeah.
And it turns out that he really is sort of the glue for this island community. That was very interesting to me, but also the fact that this is an island that I think people have a certain impression of,
yeah,
Nantucket. And as I sort of learned through reporting the book, there are a lot of surprising things about the island that that I think many people don't know.
Yeah, and we'll get to some of them. I don't know much about the place. I think I was one of those people who just has the, oh, it's where fancy people go to summer, and it's where the red trousers come from.
But, right. I don't own any.
No, I would love some, by the way. I'm interested in how you came to be writing this book. How did you discover him?
Yeah, it was sort of accidental. I've worked for the New York Times for, I think, 17 years. And for a lot of that time, I've been a national bureau chief. Right now, I'm a health and science reporter. But back in 2007, I was the New England bureau chief. And the national editors asked all of the national correspondents to just try to find somebody. Basically, the marching orders were somebody interesting, doing something interesting in an interesting place, but who's not famous and hasn't been written about before.
Yeah.
And so I had a few candidates. I was telling Dr. Leprey the other day, there was some guy who was doing nude bowling in Maine. I was considering that. There was a secessionist leader in Vermont.
Wow.
But I just happened to have on my desk this alumni newsletter from Tufts Medical Center. I don't really know why I saved it. And it had one little line that said, one of our alums, Dr. Timothy Leprey, is the only surgeon on Nantucket. So I thought, well, I'll give him a call. And it turned out that he was such an interesting, unusual, and engaging character just on the phone that I went out and spent a few days, wrote a piece for the New York Times, and as a result of that, got some calls from book people saw the potential, I guess, to turn it into a book.
That's awesome. In the introduction, you use a word which by the end of the book, you know, just seems like such an understatement. He's a maverick. Now, reading about him, I couldn't help thinking that more than other real-life doctors, he seemed like a TV character. He seems like Gregory House without the addiction and the bad temper. Or actually Hank Lawson on a show called Royal Pains. It doesn't seem like doctors like him exist anymore.
As I started, you know, more and more working on and spending time with him, I saw a lot of Houseian stuff too. But you're right, not without the addiction and without some of the misogyny.
Yeah.
But he's a very independent-minded person, and that presents itself in many ways. It presents itself medically. Mm-hmm. He has maintained his own practice, and he does it his own way, and he flouts the rules of the hospital and the insurance companies frequently.
Seems like he gives away a lot of care.
Gives away a lot of care, a lot of his time. He lets patients pay him in oatmeal raisin cookies or beat up 44 Magnums. He's a gun aficionado. And he just really honestly feels that his job is to take care of the patient no matter what, and that involves not only treating that specific thing that the patient has come in for, but being aware of the patient's family history, other things that might be going on, mm-hmm. and other needs that patient might have. So he will go visit people, constantly checking up on them. They can call him at home. They drop by. It drives his wife crazy.
Yeah, because medicine is systematized. Generally, people, doctors have 6 minutes and no more. And in a way, it kind of has to be that way if it's a system. You know, it's all very well to be a maverick, but I can see that this might create challenges. You wouldn't want thousands of mavericks, probably, if you were in charge of running the hospital.
One of the things I think that sort of comes across, at least came across to me as I was exploring this, is that he may be one kind of iteration of somebody who really does carve out his own way of doing things. Mm-hmm. But in a way, the hospital and a lot of the national system of healthcare that we have now is kind of the other extreme,
right.
where everything has become so systematized and bite-sized, and doctors don't like it, patients don't like it, things fall through the cracks,
right.
people don't get followed up on, mistakes get made. And so I think that there probably should be some sort of middle ground.
Right,
there
right.
are people who continue to practice the way that Dr. Lepre does, maybe not quite with all the sort of personality quirks
right,
and
right.
weird hobbies and things
right.
like that. But I think in almost every community, particularly small towns, but also in, you know, urban areas, there are people who try very hard to carve out individual, you know, one-on-one patient relationships, because that's, when it comes down to it, the technology is great, but what you really need to do is relate to your patient and understand what's going on with them.
Right. And when he's faced with potential surgery, it seems that one of Dr. Lepre's most difficult and important decisions is whether to do the work himself or whether to send the patients off island. That's something quite specific to Nantucket.
Right. One of the interesting things about Nantucket, which again, I think people don't quite realize, it has become more accessible in the last several years, but it's still an island 30 miles out to sea, and it's still very much at mercy of the elements. So fog, rain, wind, you can be landlocked there. You can be stranded there. And so he frequently faces those kinds of situations.
Yeah.
He has a patient. Maybe he can, you know, handle it. But what happens if the patient goes south a few hours later when the fog's going to roll in? So that's one element. The other is that he's got a small hospital there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got 19 beds. It's got one operating room. It's got no real kind of surgical recovery staff.
Mm-hmm.
So
and very little blood, you said.
And very little blood, 6 units of blood, which is about, you know, enough for maybe one very serious operation.
Why does it not have more?
Yeah, they get their blood from the Red Cross, and I guess they, you know, they get it sort of doled out to them.
Right,
and they can get more, but it takes a couple of days. It depends on when they need it. So he's got all of those things to consider. There's no obstetrician. So a lot of the things he comes up against are pregnant women who need emergency C-sections.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who's going to do that. So there's a lot of balancing that he has to figure out.
And you point out that one of the ways in which he's different is that these days there's an increased tendency towards specialization, and he is very much general.
Exactly.
As we mentioned before, Lepre has become an expert on tick-borne diseases of necessity because Nantucket has so many of them. That is both deers and ticks. The highest concentration of deer in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
How did he come to, you know, become an expert?
Well, I think it's partly out of necessity and partly out of obsession.
Yeah. He is very prone to obsession.
I just saw him a few days ago, and he was wearing a T-shirt that said Nantucket, and it had a little picture of a tick on it. It is a place where Lyme disease and other even more serious tick-borne diseases have become very concentrated. I think they are spreading throughout the country, particularly the eastern United States, but Nantucket, because of the environment there, and because through a very sort of odd accident 60 or 80 years ago, ended up having a deer basically swim ashore.
Right.
And then they thought, well, the deer might get lonely, so they imported a couple of other deer.
It's a great story. Yeah.
From Michigan. They enlisted this ambassador who happened to be a Nantucket resident to sort of broker the whole deer exchange, which I thought was pretty funny.
And so they became very fond of their deer.
They became very fond of their deer, and their deer have, you know, really nowhere else to go, so they have propagated like
deer do.
Deer or bunnies. And so then the deer are a very key component of the tick life cycle. So there are a lot of ticks. Because of other animals on the island, there's sort of concentrated infections. Mm-hmm. A lot of the ticks there get multiple kinds of infections, which they then transmit to us. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty serious situation. And some of these diseases like babesiosis and anaplasmosis can kill you.
And if they don't kill you, they can really debilitate.
Exactly, yeah.
And you say that the knowledge of them and the sort of concern about these tick diseases really puts a strain on the hospital.
Right. One of the difficulties is that you don't always know, frequently you don't know, with Lyme disease if you have it or not. It's hard to diagnose. So people come in thinking that they may have Lyme, and they don't. They still have to be examined and treated for whatever they have. So it's both a reality in terms of the high numbers of cases and also the high numbers of false alarms.
Well, you know, just reading the book, I became convinced that I had something. So I can understand their concern. And as you mentioned, Dr. Leffery has a controversial position on how to deal with the problem.
Right. One of the interesting things about him is, you know, you have to remember Massachusetts is maybe the bluest of blue states, right? And Nantucket is, you know, one of the bluer places. I mean, it has a history of Quaker background and abolitionism, and most people are pretty liberal there. Here comes Dr. Leffery, and he not only sees this from a medical point of view, but he is a hunter, or likes to think he's a hunter, and he is an NRA member, and he spouts off various, mostly libertarian, but sort of conservative libertarian comments. And so his point of view, and most mainstream scientists agree with him, they may not express it quite the way he does, is that really the only way to deal with controlling tick diseases is to reduce the deer population. And that's very controversial on the island because people have a lot of affection for deer.
And when you say reduce the deer population, generally it means shooting them. Yeah,
yeah. there are different ways to do that. You can try sterilizing them, but most ways except for, you know, letting hunters have at it are expensive.
Let's pause for a moment to give away some books. But first, I want to let you know that this month, The Afterword is sponsored by Audible.com. They're offering a free audiobook to any U.S. listener who signs up for a new 30-day free trial. Audible has more than 100,000 audiobooks available for download, as well as audio versions of newspapers and magazines. Membership also includes free access to the daily audio digest version of The New York Times or The Wall Street Journal. Island Practice isn't available on Audible for the moment, at least, but listeners who are interested in doctors and medicine might enjoy Jerome Grutman's book, How Doctors Think, which is, to get your 30-day free trial, which will allow you to download one of the 100,000 audiobooks available on Audible, go to audiblepodcast.com/afterword. If you use that URL, the afterword will get credit. That's audiblepodcast.com/afterword. Now, Public Affairs has very kindly given us some copies of Island Practice to give away to listeners, and Pam has even signed them. If you would like one, send an email with the words Island Giveaway in the subject line to slateafterword@gmail.com by 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time on Friday, June 15th, 2012, and we'll choose the winners at random. If you've been lucky in one of our previous giveaways, please don't enter for at least 3 months after a win to give other listeners a chance. We'll contact the lucky responders so that we can get their postal address. And if you have any feedback about the podcast, please send it to the same address, slateafterword@gmail.com. I'm talking with Pam Bellock, author of the new book, Island Practice, Cobblestone Rash, Underground Tom, and Other Adventures of a Nantucket Doctor. Now, without wishing any disrespect to the good doctor, he's a little weird, right?
I would say that's a fair assessment.
As you mentioned, he has more than 200 guns. He carves stone arrowheads and wooden duck decoys. And until he lost the ability to sterilize them, he sometimes performed surgery, with permission, using scalpels that he'd carved from obsidian.
Right, yes.
So I mean, he's just eccentric?
He's very eccentric. Actually, I was just there and I found something else that I didn't know about for the book, that he was collecting rabbit skulls of sort of roadkill that he picks up because he has a red-tailed hawk, doesn't everybody? He was letting them dry out so that he could try to see whether, I think I have this right, how many were Eastern cottontails and how many were New England cottontails, because New England cottontails are supposed to be endangered and there may not be any left, and he was trying to figure out if he could find them. I think that it's partly that he is just an unusual person, and Nantucket is a place that allows people like that some room to thrive without judgment. Mm-hmm. But I also think that these types of hobbies and obsessions are his way of dealing with what is really enormous stress involved in the job of any doctor, but in particular the kinds of things that he confronts and the fact that he makes himself available 24/7. Right. And so you're in a small community. Some people deal with that in less healthy ways, and his way is to sort of throw himself into some sort of hobby.
Yeah.
And he actually told me that, because one of the things that I found sort of counterintuitive was, you know, here you are, a doctor, you're in the business of saving lives, and one of the things that you like to do is shoot things, and your office is decked out with really instruments of death. His exam rooms are named for weapons, and they're all over his office. It seems like there's some cognitive dissonance there, but from his point of view, he sees this act of shooting as kind of one of the only things that he can do that requires the kind of concentration that he also has to apply to surgery. So when he is shooting a gun, whether it's at a shooting range or down in his basement, which he has demonstrated for me, he feels that he has to really, it's one of the only times where he cannot be thinking about what might have gone wrong in surgery or what's happening with one of his patients. Yeah. And so it focuses him and distracts him from that stress.
It seems like a really good strategy. I was very struck by your chapter on alcohol and substance abuse on Nantucket. It's a really tough place to live, and it's also hard to get away from.
Right. I think it's, again, one of these things that you don't quite expect, because you do think of Nantucket as sort of this playground for the rich. But people who live there year-round, about 10,000 people, probably more if you count the immigrants who come, they are under a lot of pressure 6 months of the year at least. It empties out. It's hard to make a living. Mm. It's bleak. It's most of my trips for the book were not in July, but in sort of November and February. March they call hate month, because it just becomes so bleak, and people are all kind of weary from the stir crazy from the winter, and there's a lot of stress, and you're in a small community where kind of everybody knows what you're doing.
Yeah.
If you have some sort of issue there, you might need to talk to somebody about it. There aren't too many places to go, and people know if you're going to the Nantucket Behavioral Health Office. They can see your car parked there.
Yeah.
So it's difficult, and that has, I think, led to probably a higher number of people with alcohol problems. One of the few things that stays open in the winter are bars. And so, you know, Dr. Lepre has become kind of a counselor for those types of things, too.
You mentioned that he tried to intervene on behalf of heroin addicts because they were having to travel to the mainland with great frequency to get methadone treatment.
Right.
How long does it take to get to and forth for that treatment?
If you get a fast ferry, the fast ferry is an hour, but it is more expensive than the slow ferry, which is about 2 hours and 15 minutes. One of the issues is not just the time it takes, but if you're having to go in the middle of the day and you're somebody who's struggling to make a living on Nantucket, it's hard for you to take that time out in the middle of the day.
Right.
And, you know, in addition to all these other issues, one thing people may not realize is that Nantucket is the cost of living there, even for the year-rounders, is really quite a bit higher than the mainland, just because it's hard to get stuff there, and housing prices are so high. It's got the highest median housing price in the country. So if gas is $4 in Boston, it's going to be $5 on Nantucket. You know, same kind of thing with groceries. So it really puts a lot of pressure on people.
You talk about how certain parts of Dr. Lepre's practice and habits are extremely unorthodox. For example, he's helped patients dealing with chemotherapy get their hands on marijuana cookies. Was there any concern about kind of revealing that in your book?
I didn't have any concern. I have to say that one of the great pleasures of working on this book as a journalist, because I was very committed to having it be a journalistic mm-hmm. book. There are some biographical elements to it. It's not a biography. Mm-hmm. It's not hagiography. I have had increasing respect for Dr. Lepre as a subject, because he never tried to steer me away from anything yeah. or ask me not to put something in. And he introduced me to his pot supplier. Yeah. You know, I think from the doctor's point of view, he's not a marijuana fan. He's not somebody who wants to legalize marijuana, but he feels it's important for some patients. There are synthetic alternatives, but they're expensive. Insurance doesn't cover them. Mm. And, you know, he saw a patient who was struggling, and he had another patient who he knew was a stoner. And he said, "Do you ever bake these things into cookies? How about you make me some?" And so now he has a whole little... system going there. And I don't know whether there'll be any repercussions, but I think probably most people looking at that would see it as though the need for the patients is probably greater than yeah. the need to lock up
I hope so.
Henry.
Indeed. Dr. Lepre also performs abortions, though he himself is anti-abortion, which has caused some strife in his office. But again, tell us why, you know, what his thought process is.
Yeah, that's caused a lot of tension between him and his nurses and some others at the hospital as well. You know, he was raised Catholic. He's not very religious right now, but he's not, you know, he listens to Rush Limbaugh. He's not an abortion rights advocate yeah. by any means, but he feels it's legal. Some women feel that it's something that they, you know, then they need to avail of. And it turns out very few doctors, even in Massachusetts, actually will perform abortions because they're concerned about the liability. They're concerned about getting threats, which Dr. Lepre has mm-hmm, gotten.
Mm-hmm. And protests outside the clinic.
Yeah. And so it is, you know, it's a lightning rod of an issue. And actually there was one doctor on Cape Cod, which we describe in the book, who appeared to be the only doctor outside of Boston who performed abortions, and he went to jail because a patient died as a result of an abortion. And nobody else was taking that on. There was mm-hmm. a meeting of doctors on Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard, and none of them would touch it. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Lepre said, "Well, you know, I don't like it, but I'll do it." Yeah. And he does.
I'm curious about how you handled the tricky business of patient confidentiality and sort of the ethical considerations around revealing real people's medical histories. As you said, it's a work of journalism. Mm-hmm. You usually use people's full names.
Yes.
So was that tricky?
It really wasn't so difficult. A lot of people have remarked on that, but I have a lot of experience doing mm-hmm. these types of stories for the New York Times. I've written about a lot of sensitive mm-hmm. subjects. And typically, the way that I try to approach it is to just be very upfront with people about what the subject is about, what the mm-hmm. story is going to be about, how their story would be represented. And I try to make sure that they're comfortable with that. Depending on the type of story, there can be a lot of consultation about what they're comfortable revealing and not. But typically I find that people are willing to share their stories. They have different motivations for mm-hmm. doing that. In this case, I think a lot of the patients were really actually kind of interested in talking about how Dr. Lepre helped them. Mm. And I think, you know, it's partly just an approach to people. I don't make any judgments about what they're revealing. I'm very interested in their stories. Mm. And so I try to just approach it with respect. And that seems to encourage people to feel like sharing.
Yeah. And definitely the book does seem stronger for it. It's clearly journalism, it's clearly real. And so I applaud that. The end of the book is a little disconcerting because it really stresses how atypical Dr. Lepre is, but also he's 67. The hospital where he works has been taken over by a larger medical system. As you say, he's chosen to stay independent. But it's harder for him to continue his maverick ways, and the hospital itself is in bad financial shape. You just kind of have this feeling of, he's irreplaceable. Now, what happens when he finally does retire or stop practicing?
Yeah, that is, you know, a big question. I think the hospital is basically, that's their nightmare scenario, is what happens if he retires, because it's going to be very hard to find somebody who wants to live on the island, do that kind of combination of surgery and general practice, be as widely available as he is. I think they really rely on having him fill in so many gaps. I mean, there are a few other year-round doctors there, but most of them are much more conventional and in the way that they practice and the way and their hours. So it will be very interesting to see what happens.
Pam, thanks once again for sharing this fabulous story. That was Pam Bellick, whose book Island Practice, Cobblestone Rash, Underground Tom, and Other Adventures of a Nantucket Doctor is available in bookstores now. If you have any comments about our discussion, send them to slateafterword@gmail.com. Our engineer was Chris Wade. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Andy Bowers. Thanks for listening to The Afterword. For Slate.com, I'm June Thomas.